As the world comes to grips with climate change, it's not surprising that a few people would feel overwhelmed. Something along the lines of, I'm one person, what can I do? Well, our guest this hour has a few ideas. Casey Golden has been working to change the world for a long time. He speaks in Ashland tonight at 6:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. The talk is titled Climate Solutions. We have met the hero, and it is us. Casey Golden is the board chair at 350.org on the staff at Climate Solutions, where he's a senior policy advisor. He has a long history in that role for the city of Seattle and the state of Washington at various times. He was the executive director once of the Northwest Energy Coalition. And Casey was given the Heinz Award for Public Policy in 2012 for a lifetime achievement as a climate advocate and policy architect. So quite a record of accomplishment there, Casey Golden. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you feel like good progress is being made despite what we see in terms of numbers and ice pack and polar bears and all the rest?
Yeah, well, the science is scary. You know, there's no sugarcoating that. And we'd be in better shape had we started early. Yesterday would have been better, but today's great too. And the answer to your question is yes, I really do see immense progress after 25, 30 years working on this. Just in the last 4 or 5 years, things are really starting to converge toward the kind of transformation that we need in our energy system. And it's in many ways, you know, despite the incredible setbacks in our national political level, it is very encouraging to see that transformation really starting to dig in and build momentum now. The clean energy revolution has been launched. The climate movement is active and fierce throughout the world and here in southern Oregon. People are starting to experience consequences, so I think it's sinking in a way that isn't really theoretical anymore. And I think people are kind of waking up to the idea that this is what we got to do for our kids. This is a moral challenge.
I'm curious to know about the things that would inspire people to take part in the clean energy revolution, to move away from fossil fuels and into cleaner energies, because it seems like the kinds of choices that people make are often about their own personal circumstances. I mean, when gas was expensive, SUV sales started to drop a bit, and so did pickup trucks as well, big things that used a lot of fuel. With gas generally under $3 a gallon across the country now, it seems like SUVs are selling like hotcakes again. So is it motivated as much by altruism, a sense of what I can do for the planet, as it is by what I can do for me?
Honestly, I think it can be both. And I think it has to be motivated by a sense that we can make this change, but only if we do it collectively. You know, I think you said at the top of the hour, people worry, you know, what can one person do? Well, the truth is, if it's just you by your lonely self, not much. But if all of us get together and wage this clean energy revolution, we can win it. And I think the most motivating thing in some ways that I find when I talk to people about this is how close we already are in so many ways, how far the clean energy revolution has come. Electric vehicles are not very far behind, and we know how to power them with clean electricity. Solar energy deployment and wind energy deployment are now dominating new energy markets throughout the world. And if you listen to the debate in Salem or in Washington, D.C., or kind of the political and policy narrative about energy, you would think that we're 20 years behind where we really are. The ability to power modern, comfortable lifestyles with clean energy and with energy efficiency and using less is now within our grasp. And I think that's what people find motivating, that these options really are becoming available.
Well, in fact, some of this is past tense. I mean, in Seattle, didn't you help the city utility go completely carbon-free?
Zero carbon for all of Seattle, and not just, you know, Seattle, the municipality, but Seattle, the whole community. Zero carbon in our electricity supply. We enjoy some of the cleanest air and the cheapest electricity in the nation, not in spite of that commitment, but because of it.
What are the sources then?
Hydropower, you know, we've had hydropower for a long time, but when I joined the city in the late 1990s, we still had a big share of a coal plant and a big natural gas plant. We phased those out. We built new wind power. We invested very heavily in wasting less energy, and we found that that was the cheapest and most economical and cleanest thing we could do with our energy dollars. We've built wind, we've built solar, and we've phased out all our fossil fuels.
How keep the faith, I wonder, at a place like 350.org, where you're on the board, the chair at the moment, in fact, given that the number that 350 refers to, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is behind us. It's no longer something we want to stop at. It's something we want to get back to.
Yes, it is. And, you know, it doesn't last forever, so it is possible to get back to it. But we have to start right away by taking no more big steps backwards. And that's why some of our signature campaigns at 350.org have been the Keystone Pipeline, the DAPL project in North Dakota. We cannot take any of these big, long-term, capital-intensive steps in the wrong direction anymore. It's the first rule for getting out of a hole, stop digging. And if we can do that, if we can keep the space open, if we cannot waste our precious time and energy dollars on making the problem worse, we're very bullish on the idea that we do know how to make it better, and we're on our way to doing that. We just have to escape the old ideas before we can implement the new ones.
You mentioned DAPL and Keystone XL, and I'll throw a third one in there, Pacific Connector, which is the pipeline envisioned to run from the Klamath Basin to North Bend for a gas export terminal. They all looked moribund last year. They're all alive again now. I mean, there is going to be some fallback, it seems like, with the current regime in power.
We don't know that yet. We certainly have more sympathy. We have more of a willingness on the part of the new federal administration to serve the interests of the oil and gas and coal companies who have proposed these projects. But that doesn't change the fundamental fact that the fossil fuel era is waning. It is on its way out. The coal industry can't be revived. After the election, people said, okay, it's a new era for coal, and people, you know, coal prices coal stocks are going to bounce back. Well, between 2011 and 2016, coal lost 99.9% of its market value. All of the major coal companies went bankrupt.
Its stock value?
Its stock value, 99.9%. And then it bounced back after the election. So now it's lost 99% of its value instead of 99.9%. These technologies are the energy past. And nothing that politicians can do can revive them. They can slow down our transition. They can waste our time. They can make it harder when we should be making it easier. But energy markets are speaking clearly that it's time for clean energy technology to move in and replace the fossil fuel age.
Back with Casey Golden on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about global warming on a more or less global scale. Casey Golden's been fighting this fight for a long time now in a number of different positions. He's currently on the staff at Climate Solutions, where he's a senior policy advisor. He is the board chair at 350.org and has worked for the city of Seattle and the state of Washington. Got the Heinz Award for Public Policy in 2012 for lifetime achievement as a climate advocate and policy architect. Speaks in Ashland tonight at 6:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. Climate Solutions, we have met the hero, and it is us. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I think you probably remember the Pogo cartoons of years gone by, which explains the title.
They will appear in my presentation tonight.
Which was the old line was, we have met the enemy and they is us.
Right, right. And that's holding us back, to be honest. You know, we're all responsible for climate change, but we shouldn't waste too much time sitting around wringing our hands, blaming ourselves for living our lives in the only energy system that exists. It's time to change that system, to exercise our choice, not just as consumers, but as citizens, and take back our power to forge a different energy future.
But you know, when you call it the merging of petro and state, and you keep referring to Rex Tillerson as T-Rex, the new Secretary of State, came directly from ExxonMobil to that position. Lots of people who feel friendly about the petroleum industry in positions of power in the current administration.
They sort of cut out the middleman.
went straight to the top. So, but given that, I mean, I can't imagine that you don't feel at least a few moments of, I don't know, if not pessimism, at least like concern about where you're trying to take things with a transformation to a clean energy economy with the quote-unquote dirty energy guys in control.
Sure. It's a huge setback. Let's not sugarcoat that at all. But it's not about optimism or pessimism. It's about determination. It's about which future we're going to choose. And that choice is still in our hands. It was true in the Obama years. It would have been true under President Clinton. It's still true under President Trump. We're going to get less help from the federal government. But we have long since stopped waiting for the federal government to ride in on a white horse and save us. We are building a clean energy future in the Northwest. Communities like Ashland just last night passed a stellar climate and clean energy plan. We're going to show that this can be done in our homes, in our communities, in our lives. And, you know, the federal government will always be slow to pick up the slack. And that'll be true now more than ever. We are very worried about the federal government taking steps back now when we were starting to make some progress forward. But the game, the power of this transition is still very much in the hands of people in local communities. We're going to win this or not.
Or not?
Well, it is our choice. Mm-hmm. I think the hardest thing about sort of overcoming the kind of fear and immobilization around climate is that we don't feel like it's our choice, right? We feel like it's bigger than us, or it's ruled by politicians that we can't control. And you know, if I leave Ashland with only one message, it's that we have now been shaping our destiny for the last 5 years, and we've been shaping it in a very positive direction, and that's what we need to continue to do.
You know, when I think about the overall arc of your career, which is about shaping policy and shaping the messages about that to get people to support it, and it just seems like the earth is getting hotter with more fires and higher oceans is a pretty clear message. I mean, why does it seem so hard to get people to buy into action on that?
I think it goes back to what you said earlier. I think people understandably don't want to be responsible for a problem they don't think they can fix. Some folks are having an argument about the science, but there is no scientific debate. There hasn't been one for 25 or 30 years. So what poses as a scientific debate is really political theater. And I think most folks understand that. And they look at this and they say they're not scientists themselves, and they say, well, you know, one side says this, one side says that. The truth must be somewhere in between. Well, that's not how physics works. That might be a good rule of thumb sometimes for politics, but science is what it is, and it doesn't adjust to the political moment very well. I think, to be honest, the best thing we can do to kind of get over the hump of fully accepting the science is fully understanding and executing our ability to do something about it. It only makes sense to fully take on this problem if we think we can really be effective in developing and delivering solutions in our communities. And the good news is we can, and Ashland is.
Casey Golden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His talk in Ashland tonight is called Climate Solutions. We have met the hero, and it is us, 6:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. Speaking of science, though, and to get back to what you were just saying, I mean, you can't go a few days and maybe even minutes without some refutation like, well, the satellite temperatures tell a different story, or you know, I actually checked this out recently, went to Fox News just to see what they were leading with, and it was scientists manipulates climate data. Yeah. You know, there's something out there all the time, and this is an era when even the President of the United States embraces fiction. That's a pretty tough obstacle, I would think.
Alternative facts. Senator Moynihan famously said, we're all entitled to our own opinions. We're not entitled to our own facts. And boy, is that more important now than ever. I think it's just really important to remember, yeah, you keep running across these things, but you don't keep running across them from credentialed scientists who understand how climate really works. That jury has been in for a long time. So it's clear that we're not having a science debate. We're having a political fight.
But then there's even the less accusatory version of that, the one that doesn't put any particular pressure on scientists or consensus or any of that, which is, well, the climate always varies on the Earth is the other variation of that.
Mm-hmm. And indeed it has, and you can see that in the fossil record, and we're now well outside of the range of natural variation, pushed by the accumulation of heat trapped by carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. There is no dispute in the scientific community about any of those basic facts. It's really simple physics, and it's as clear as day.
There was a great phrase you put in a recent blog post that sincere, passionate climate advocates trying to unwrap climate from the axle of political dysfunction. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way to look at things, that you're trying to pull it apart from the political system up to a point, I would think.
You do. I mean, you know, you can't wish away political dysfunction, right? We got to navigate through it somehow. I do think it is very important, though, for people to, you know, so often information about climate comes to us press, you said you hear on Fox News, X, Y, and Z, comes to us through political channels. And I do think it's important for us to sometimes put aside that lens, look at physical facts, look at what is possible and what is going on in solutions, and, you know, not have our understanding of the physical reality of our circumstances on the planet be too heavily shaped by cable news programs.
Grab your headphones. Let's take some phone calls here. We'll start off with James in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Casey Golden. You're going to need those on to be able to hear these. So go ahead, James.
Hey, Jeffrey and Casey. Thank you for being on, Casey. I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks, James.
We had a talk last night on the way from the airport, so you're familiar with the conversation about what Ashland is doing and what the city council has just passed in terms of climate and energy action plan. We passed that on, the council passed that on Tuesday with some reservations, and rightfully so. Our goal is science-based, as you're talking about, and it's base of 8% reduction of greenhouse gases beginning this year, every year through 2050, in order to get down to a 96% reduction by 2050, which by 2100 would then, if we and everybody else on the planet did this, we would bring ourselves to parity with 350 parts per million. So my question to you is, we have set the bar very high for us in Ashland, and that includes consumption, which other cities seem not to have included in some of their goals. So we need help. I asked Senator Wyden a couple of weeks ago the same question, how can we get support, because we all are in this together. So could you speak to that about local small towns like Ashland, what we're up to, and how we can, you know, leverage or be able to leverage a much bigger thing out there on a global scale?
All right. Thanks for the question, James.
It's a great question, James, and our heroic local efforts, and I do think Ashland's are heroic, aren't going to amount to much if we don't figure out the answer to that question, right? Because we don't control everything we need to control to enable you to deliver on that ambitious commitment. And you said Ashland's setting the bar high, and it certainly is compared to other communities, and I commend you for it. I do want to say in another way, though, just based on the discussion we were having before, if you take off the political lens and put on the physics lens, the bar is the bar. That's what we got to do to save ourselves. So it sounds ambitious. It sounds hard. Can we do it? Is it possible? There's only one way to find out, and it starts with pointing ourselves at the reality of what the science says we have to do. And I really congratulate the community for being willing to do that, even without fully knowing every answer to every question about how you're going to do it going forward. In terms of how we get together as communities, cities have been very influential in pushing state climate policy, in pushing the federal government, although the federal government is way behind the eight ball on this, and even in pushing the international negotiations. Leading cities, big cities and small cities alike, have played an immensely important role in achieving policy victories at higher levels of government that are going to enable you to do what you can do locally and also do that within the context of state and national and global commitments that help move the ball forward. We got a long way to go, but by making this kind of commitment, I think you put Ashland on very solid ground to go to Salem, to go to D.C., to go to the international negotiations and say, we're committed to do this and we need you to step up.
Climate change and climate action, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Casey Golden's been at it for a long time. He's on the staff at Climate Solutions, the board chair currently at 350.org, visiting Ashland for a talk tonight at 6:30 at Southern Oregon University's Science Building called Climate Solutions. We have met the hero, and it is us. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Couple of contacts waiting. Here's Tony and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Casey Golden.
Hello, Mr. Golden.
Hi, Tony.
Sound just like your brother, who is another secular Armageddonist.
Jeff Golden, and, the former host of the show. And yes,
yeah,
they do sound alike.
I'm surprised you didn't introduce him that way. Yeah. You've got a very similar voice pattern. You're hiding behind, I think, the popular view that 97% of scientists, this is this study by John Cook, the proposition that climate change is real and man-made. Nobody's really ever shown anything like a consensus among scientists for the proposition that climate change is going to be dangerous. And I remember Christopher Hitchens once said, don't take refuge in the false security of consensus. And even Richard Feynman, who was a real scientist, said science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. You should include in your treatise, I think, something about the good that CO2 does for the Earth. It's been,
like
I
what,
think,
Tony?
Shown that. Sorry?
Like what?
The increase in vegetation. 14% increase in the so-called greening of the planet over the last 30 years. I recommend you to read a Royal Society report by Matt Ridley, somebody I've been trying to get on this program, but of course he has a contrary view, so he's not allowed on, in the UK, Lord Ridley, who explains how the studies indicate that there is a 14% increase in the vegetation on the planet, and the estimates, according to the science, is about 70% of that is due to the increase in CO2. So I think, and of course, really there is there's been so much doomsaying by, as I say, the Armageddonists like yourself, that really, if you look at the past, there's never been much. Well, there's no reason really to be that sure that the future is going to be anything like the predictions. They're very poor at predicting the future. I mean, there's at least
okay, let's allow time
20
for
or 30 here, of predictions that I've made in the last 30 years that are way off. And you know what they are, but I guess you're making money. I don't know. Good for you.
Thank you, Tony.
So I guess the proposition is climate change. Well, climate change is happening, but maybe it's a good thing. And that is refreshingly optimistic, shall we say. You know, look, if we got to create a planet from scratch, you might say, I'd make it a little warmer in northern Canada because I like, you know, but we live on a planet that is exquisitely and expensively adapted to the climate we have. And California, for instance, is now dealing with the consequences of a climate that's outside of the bounds of their infrastructure and what their dams and other systems can handle. You can't just throw the most important physical variable that determines the habitability of the planet, the climate system, up in the air and say, hey, maybe the pieces will come down in a nice place. I just don't think that's a realistic plan. I don't feel safe leaving my kids that world.
Let's go to another call from Dan in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Casey Golden.
Yeah, hi, Jeff and Casey. Casey, I wanted to mention the book that Sheldon Whitehouse just published, Captured. He notices that prior to 2010, Republicans actually presented a handful of climate-friendly policies. However, 2010 and Citizens United, all of that quit. So I think the point is that the influence of large dollars in our Congress is obviously palpable, and that's the kind of thing. So as we get working on climate initiatives, we really need to just completely, we got to get out of Citizens United. And I can't see that as other than a complete impediment going forward, so long forward that we won't be able to recover from it.
Amen. So amen. You know, you think, how are we going to live our lifestyles, you know, after oil? And most of us are doing our best to choose more sustainable lifestyles and to help be part of the transition. And most of us would choose even more sustainable lifestyles if those choices were available. The reason we're not choosing them is not because we've met the enemy and the enemy is us. The reason is those choices have been forestalled by exactly what you just described. I mean, 2008, both presidential candidates ran on climate bills. And so you're right. Money in politics has very much shaped this. The unprecedented, concentrated political and economic interest of the fossil fuel industry is standing between us and the clean energy revolution that we know is possible. We got to remove that obstacle.
Well, and then here's another email on that very same subject from Joe in Talent, who writes, I fear our efforts to stop or even talk about climate change will take another huge step backwards. Every time a Republican takes control, a lot of the progress made is erased. Reagan came in, and one of the first things he did was take down the solar panels on the White House just to make progressives cry and show his priorities, making the rich richer. Bush was no friend of the movement, and I think Trump represents the culmination of 40 years of effort to monetize Earth's resources regardless of the effects. That from Joe in Talent.
I think that's true. I will say the dysfunction is bipartisan. The fossil fuel industry has its hooks plenty deep into both parties. But the history that you just went through is sad and true. We could have been much farther along. President Carter started us on a clean energy path, and had we stayed the course, we would be in so much better shape right now. But that was then, and I got to tell you, it's a darn good thing we spent the last 8 years launching the clean energy revolution. These things are now ready and available and commercially competitive in a way that they weren't 6 years ago, and no political administration can run back the clock on that. They're going to put a lot of obstacles in our way, but the basic underlying economics of this and the basic underlying technology are moving in the right direction. The writing is on the wall for the fossil fuel era.
Casey Golden, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about climate change and approaches to it. His talk tonight at Southern Oregon University is called Climate Solutions. We have met the hero, and it is us, a take on the old pogo cartoons. Mm. We have met the enemy, and they is us. That speech is tonight at 6:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. We'll come back and talk more with Casey Golden here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about climate change here on the Jefferson Exchange today with Casey Golden, who's been working for Solutions for a long time. In fact, he's on the staff at Climate Solutions in Seattle. He is also currently the board chair at 350.org. His work at Climate Solutions means he's a senior policy advisor, which is the kind of thing he's done over the years for the city of Seattle and the state of Washington and other organizations. Got the Heinz Award for Public Policy in 2012 for lifetime achievement as a climate advocate and policy architect, speaking tonight at Southern Oregon University at 6:30 at the Science Building. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Obviously, we got back into the politics again, but which raises the question. You're talking about the climate revolution, the clean energy revolution being unwrapped ultimately from the political process. I mean, is it getting to a point where it's immune, where the momentum is built up in places like Ashland, which, as you just pointed out last night, passed the Clean Energy Action Plan?
No, I don't want to say it's immune, and I don't want to say it's unwrapped. Our politics matters. We got to get control of our political institutions if we're going to wage and win this revolution at the scale that we need to do it. But the best way to do that is to get ourselves in gear and start doing it in our communities and where we can. And Ashland's doing that, proving that it can be done. And the reason that I hold out a lot of hope about that is that I don't think anybody would consciously choose the future we're going to get with fossil fuel dependence as usual. I think the big obstacle is people really wonder if we do have a choice. And I think the more, while our political systems continue to stall, the more people can demonstrate in their own lives, in their communities, in their businesses, in their technologies, that the solutions are possible, that we do have a choice, and it's a better choice. We can produce more prosperity and more broadly shared prosperity than fossil fuels do. When we start to believe that is when we start to win on climate.
How different do you think the last 5 years might have been if gasoline still cost $4 and still came largely from Saudi Arabia?
Well, that's a double-edged sword because low gas prices have also forestalled a lot of upstream investment, if you will. It has. That's part of the reason that Shell turned around and stopped drilling in the Arctic. You can't justify a lot of long-term investment in expensive oil supplies when gas markets are glutted the way they are. So it's ironic. I never would have thought I would be sitting here saying that, you know, low gas prices saved us for a while. But in some ways it did, because you got to think about this as a really long-term proposition. The most important thing we need to do now is avoid investing today's energy capital in 40, 50-year pipelines and power plants that we're going to have to keep repaying with our energy dollars. That locks us in to a future of climate catastrophe.
When that infrastructure is there, it has to be used.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It has to be paid for, and the banks are all into it, and it becomes very difficult to unwind ourselves. So if we can avoid digging the hole deeper now and avoid locking ourselves into climate catastrophe now, then we hold open the space to continue to build and prove out this clean energy future that's becoming more possible and attractive every day.
Let's take another call. Here is Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Casey Golden.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to just make a couple practical comment questions. Getting back to what Tony said about the carbon dioxide increasing the growth of plant life, I think the studies I've seen have shown that that is true in some instances if there is adequate water, but that faster growth requires increased nutrient and water, and therefore, you know, is highly variable. And then also, just, you know, and I really liked what you said about, you know, if we could create a planet, you know, from scratch, it would be one thing, but we can't. And, you know, just having compassion for people who do have their blind spots. We all have facts we don't want to face, and lifestyles we don't want to give up. Air travel being a big blind spot for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you offset the air travel that you undoubtedly do.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the question, Cynthia.
The most important way is I actually do just fly less. I think more about it. I mean, I fly to do my work because I honestly think I can do more work to reduce emissions by helping to seed and wage and win this clean energy revolution. And some of that involves getting myself to other cities in ways that I can't do on my bicycle, unfortunately. So I do that, but I do it more advisedly. And I don't, you know, I think people in rich countries have kind of gotten used to the idea that, you know, you go to, you know, New York to see a show for the weekend or to go to a friend's birthday or that kind of thing. I don't think that's responsible anymore. But I also really want to say, you know, yes, let's all be more conscious and more responsible about those critical consumer choices. But let's not waste much more time or energy blaming ourselves for living our lives in the only energy system that exists. We are going to have to change this system to give ourselves better options. Most of us, I think, would be willing to live more sustainable lifestyles with better choices in the context of a real plan to save ourselves from climate change. That's the context we got to create to make sense of our individual actions.
So by expanding the range of choices we have now, I mean, this really ends up being a voting with your dollars thing up to a point, I would think. I mean, so buy electric cars. I mean, is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely. And electric cars, you know, electric cars, again, would have been available and cheaper and mass marketed by 20 years ago had we continued on the right policy path. You know, we struggled. We had our ups and downs, but they're just about there now. I think everybody should have a bumper sticker that says, this is my last gas car. And I can tell you, electric cars, you know, yes, there's a little bit more of a ways to go on battery technology and range and that kind of thing. But you're now seeing it's not just Teslas and expensive stuff. Commercially mass marketed, affordable cars that are just better in every way. So much cleaner, so much cheaper to use, so much cheaper to fuel, require almost no more maintenance. I don't think it's going to be very long before we're going to look at gas-powered cars as dinosaurs. Germany has already slated the ban of internal combustion engines by 2030. And Germany's a country that is much more dominated by its auto industry than we are.
They build a lot of cars in Germany, absolutely. Yeah. So this raises the question about transitions in manufacturing sector and stuff like that. I mean, do some jobs disappear overnight? I mean, do budget deficits balloon in the short term? And is there an ARG factor for you in that these always seem to be raised in these discussions?
Yeah. I mean, I think the important thing to say is this is a very economically promising transition, and particularly for people who don't enjoy the benefits of the fossil fuel economy. If you had to invent a system for sucking dollars out of everybody's pocket and delivering it to the top of the economic pyramid, you would invent oil and coal. That's why they call oil the prize. That's why they fight wars over it. That's why the biggest fortunes have been made over it. So when we make the transition to clean energy, we're not going to stop using energy, but we're going to use energy sources like solar that cannot be monopolized in the same way. And I think we're going to have much more broadly shared prosperity because of it. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that the transition is going to be good or easy for everyone. Transitions are never easy, especially in a society like this where, you know, we tend to throw people to the economic wolves when things change. We've got to be very focused on how to make this transition in a way that's just and in a way that really speaks to the needs of the people who live in the communities and have the jobs that are most dependent on the fossil fuel industry. We're doing that now in Washington as we phase out our only coal plant, the Centralia coal plant. We achieved a unanimous agreement among the community, the workers at the plant, the utility, the environmental community to phase out that coal plant. We're going to take our time to do it. I wish it could go faster, but you know, there'll be a lot of attrition. There'll be a lot of retraining. There'll be a lot of new investment in that community. And we did it in a way where everybody was willing to say, okay, the writing is on the wall. We're going to make this transition. We're going to make it in a way that works for the workers in the community.
But for all of the things that Washington has done, and you've lived there since the 80s and is talking about doing, there was the vote on the carbon tax last November with Initiative 732.
Yep.
Yeah. And it failed.
Yeah. I think here's my thought about that. A carbon tax is, the question is, are you willing to pay the price? And the question underneath that is, pay the price for what? I don't think it was clear enough to folks that how important ending free carbon dumping is to unlocking the clean energy future that we know is important. I still don't think, you know, I'm here talking about the clean energy revolution and I couldn't be more excited about it, but I'm also sober about the fact that not everybody sees themselves in that picture. And to be honest, I think it's easier for people of privilege to imagine themselves transitioning to an electric car or being part of a clean energy transition that's going to work for them. People who live on the economic margins don't necessarily trust and can't afford to trust that this clean energy transition is going to be good for them and isn't going to leave them behind. And I think when you say, are you willing to pay the price? I think people will say, yeah, I'm willing to pay the price for a clean energy revolution that I can be part of. I'm willing to pay the price for better alternatives to fossil fuel dependence that work for me. If you just say, are you willing to pay more for gas, then the oil companies run ads that say, well, I don't know about this clean energy revolution. It sounds good for the rich folks.
And that was the way it was characterized, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, gas will cost more.
Yeah, but you're not going anywhere. You're not going to clean energy la-la land. You're going to the gas station, and these people are going to make you pay more. Am I willing to pay the price just to pay the price? No.
And I read some of your post-election analysis about that, in which you were pointing out that it points up that when you've got people who are lower in socioeconomic concerns and not getting as much social justice as other people, they're not going to buy in as easily. And so it is ultimately, as you pointed out, your words, a very, very green, very white movement. How do you change that dynamic? How do you get buy-in from all levels, all colors, all races?
Well, and I really want to mention here that the oil industry preys on that economic insecurity mercilessly. You know, they know that we would not choose eternal fossil fuel dependence if they thought we had a good choice. And so they're busy telling people they don't have a choice. And people who can't afford to believe that they might have a choice are especially vulnerable to that message. So it's sort of a toxic combination of economic fear that works to the interests of the oil companies. I think the way you spread it is to make sure that as we make this transition, like the story I told about the coal plant, that we're making sure it's a transition that has a place for the people who are most dependent on the fossil fuel economy and can least afford the cost of increased fuel or energy costs to make this transition. We got to make sure, you know, public transit, maybe not so much in Ashland, but in our big cities, is a critical part of the option of providing better transportation service that's more affordable for more people. Making electric cars cheaper for the people who can afford them. And we're starting to do that now by building this mass market and buying more in our fleets. Clean energy needs to be made available in a way that doesn't increase costs for the people who can least afford it. And we can do that now because solar is actually competitive with coal and nuclear. It's cheaper.
Which brings up a question emailed in by Carla. I don't see the town here, but she says, what is being done about solving solar energy storage? That's been an issue with a lot of renewables, in fact, particularly wind power. It's like you get this great gust of wind and you got a lot of power coming in. What do you do with it until it's needed?
It's a great question. Looking back on, you know, what are fossil fuels? Fossil fuels are solar energy storage, right? They were once plants that got their energy from the sun that have been stored in the Earth's crust for hundreds of millions of years. And the question now is, and we've been relying on that canned energy. The question now is, well, how about fresh energy? And it turns out, there's plenty of it. The sun delivers enough energy to the Earth in an hour to serve all human energy needs for a year. And it's been doing it for going on 4 billion years now without a single outage. So it's plenty reliable. But the question is, how can we replace the convenient storage that this canned fossil fuels provided? Battery technology is coming along very fast, in part driven by the communication revolution, by cell phones and now electric cars and electric home systems. But that's not actually the only way to solve the problem of how do you match intermittent solar energy with continuous energy needs. There's a whole bunch of great ideas that are being implemented now. Demand response, making our demand more flexible, flexible water heater controls that allow the water heater to go off when the system needs the energy without you experiencing any difference in how much hot water you get. We can schedule renewables better. We can have more diversity of renewables because it turns out, like with wind power, it's not always windy in the Columbia Gorge, but when it's not windy in the Columbia Gorge, it turns out it's windy in Wyoming, and we have transmission lines to Wyoming. So this is a real challenge. I don't mean to say it's not a real problem. It is by no means an insurmountable obstacle. It's the kind of challenge that the energy system deals with all the time.
Well, you've inspired a lot of people already, and it looks like a few more here today. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the phone calls and emails here, but a lot of people wanted to talk to Casey Golden. He'll be speaking in Ashland tonight at 6:30 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. The talk is titled Climate Solutions. We have met the hero, and it is us. Casey Golden, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much. What fun to do it with you, Jeff.
Good to visit with you.